Well, it's nice to see everybody. What a nice group we have here. Festive, and some of our friends from up north are now with us again, so it's like a homecoming. So we're glad for everybody that's here. At 30,000 feet, somewhere between Dallas and Buffalo, the man put his magazine in the seat pocket and turned in my direction and asked, "What kind of work do you do?" He was asking Gary Chapman, who answered matter-of-factly. He said, quote, "I do marriage counseling and lead marriage enrichment seminars." And the other man said, "Well, you know what? I've been waiting to ask somebody this a long, long time now. I've got to ask you then, what happens to love after you get married?" "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, I've been married 3 times. And each time it was wonderful before we got married, but somehow it all fell apart after the wedding. All the love that I thought that I had for her and all the love that she seemed to have for me had evaporated. Now, I'm a fairly intelligent person. I own and manage a huge company. But I don't understand it." "Well, how long were you married?" "The first one lasted 10 years. The second time, we were married 3 years. And then I waited, and then we were married for 6 years." "Well, did your love evaporate immediately after the wedding, or was it a gradual loss?" Mr. Smiley, Chapman asked. "Well, the second one went wrong right from the very beginning. I don't know what really happened. I thought we loved each other, but the honeymoon was a disaster. And we never really recovered. We only dated 6 months. It was a whirlwind romance. It was really exciting, but after the marriage, it was a battle from the beginning. Now, in my first marriage, we had 3 to 4 great years together before the baby came. After the baby was born, I thought she gave her all of her attention to the baby, and I didn't seem to matter anymore. It was as if that was her one single goal. And after the baby was born, she no longer needed me."
"Well, did you tell her that?"
"Oh, yeah, I told her. She said I was crazy. She said I didn't understand the stress of being a 24-hour nurse. She said I should be more understanding and help her more. I really tried, but it didn't seem to make any difference. After that, we just grew further and further apart. After a while, there was no love, only deadness, and then both of us agreed, well, the marriage is over. Now, my last marriage, I really thought that one would be different. We dated each other for 2 years. I really thought we knew what we were doing. And I thought that perhaps for the first time, I really knew what it meant to be in love with someone. And I felt that she loved me. After the wedding, I don't think I changed. I continued to express love to her as I did before the marriage. I told her how beautiful she was and how proud I was to be her husband. But a few months after, she started complaining about petty things at first. Later, she went on attacking my character, telling me that she could not trust me, accusing me of not being faithful. She became a totally negative person. Before marriage, she was never that way. She was one of the most positive persons I ever met, and that's why I was attracted to her. She never complained about anything. Everything that I did was wonderful, but after we were married, I could do nothing right. Eventually, I lost my love for her and began to resent her. She obviously had no love for me. We agreed that there was no more benefit in living together, so we split. That was a year ago, so my question is, what happens to love after the wedding? Is my experience common? Is that why we have so many divorces? I can't believe that it happened to me 3 times. And those that don't divorce, do they learn to live with emptiness, or does love really stay alive in some marriages? And if so, how?" Well, brethren, that was what Mr. Chapman wrote in a very famous book that I'll refer to later. But the desire for romance and love is deeply ingrained in our lives. People flourish when they are loved. They're appreciated. And they desire that. That's natural. God is a God of love, and He wants that for all people. There are magazines, self-help books, seminars, programs, and some of them are very good.
And so I raised that same question, which is the title of this sermon, What Happens to Love After the Wedding? Two things I'd like for us to do this afternoon is, one, understand what true love is, and two, make it grow. Understand what true love is and make it grow. Now, toward the end of the sermon, I will revisit a subject that has been brought up here before. I did a sermon on this, but it's been some years ago. The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman, a fantastic tool that can be utilized. No, it isn't the Bible, but it can be a help. And it has so many insightful comments that I think it's worth referring to later on. But before we can make love grow, we have to define what is love. Now, let me give you four examples of how we can throw around a term like that in the English language. I can say to you, I love hot dogs. And I also could say, I love my mother. Now, are they the same? Are they the same type of uses for the word love? Of course not. So, I love hot dogs, I love my mother, I love to ski, and I love Mark Twain. Four words that are translated love that have slightly different meanings. Now, in the Greek language, there are three primary words, and they're that are translated into English, the word love. Three Greek words, and they have very different meanings. Those words are agape, eros, and philia. Now, agape means real outgoing concern. Outgoing concern, giving, even if there's nothing coming back in return. It is the highest form of giving. Think of Jesus Christ, as it says in John 3:16. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that basically He would die for the sins of humanity. Now, He didn't receive anything nice in return. He was severely persecuted. But He had agape love. And if you go to John 3:16, you look at that, that's the word. That's the Greek word used. It's agape. It's the highest form of love. It is totally selfless. It is altruistic in the highest degree. Now, some people talk about the love that a mother has for her children. That's a very high love. I don't know if there's a Greek counterpart word for that one. But that's high. And it's a good thing, something that God, I think, has ingrained in women. If that weren't there, the human race might not even be here at this point. But if we go over to John chapter 15, we can see another application of agape. This is what we strive for. This is what we understand when we're called to be baptized, called to be in the family of God, that among other things, that we have to have this outgoing concern, and it's not something that naturally is in us. It's something that God has to give us. It's something with God's Holy Spirit. Spirit of power, sound mind, and the fruits of His Spirit. And what is the first fruit? Galatians 5, it's love. Love, joy, peace, but love. So, if we go to John chapter 15, we see a very fundamental scripture that speaks to this godly love, this phenomenal outgoing love. In John 15, verse 13, it says, and I'm reading out of the New King James Version here, greater love, and that's greater agape, has no man than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. And we do this on a daily basis. We can be living servants, as Romans 12 and verse 2 talks about. And we are, as God gives us time and ability, able to reach out to other people and to care and ask God to help us to be able to do that. That's a wonderful, wonderful expression of outgoing concern when it can be to the lofty, high standard of agape love. Now, there's a different type of love that's also referred to, and that's while we're in the book of John, chapter 15 and verse 19. A different word is used, philia. The philia is how is the root word of the Greek word Philadelphia, which means brotherly love. But that's different than agape love. John 15:19. If you were of the world, cosmos, the society that is, would love its own. And the word love here is philia. It means to like, to like. There was a movie, Shenandoah, that came out years ago where one person was asking for the father permission to marry his daughter. And the father said, well, do you love her? And yes, I love her. And then he surprised him. He says, now, do you like her? It's important to like the one that you love. And sometimes you can love somebody, an enemy, that doesn't love you. It's good to have both. But to like someone is philia. But sometimes philia can be very conditional. In our society, we can think, well, I've got friends that I hang out with, but if they turn against me, they're not my friends. You know, on, off, on, off. So it can be conditional. Well, maybe if they become an enemy, it's not wise to try to hang out. But you have to weigh that one in its context. The bottom line is that philia concern is noble, but it's not as high as agape. Not at all. Not anywhere near. Agape makes for the most outstanding of relationships, especially when there's reciprocation, when you have two that are doing that. That's phenomenal. But the mindset of a Christian is to be a giver. Not a doormat, no, but to be able to help, to give, to care, to look after, to be having one's mind on others. It says in Acts 20 and verse 35, I'll just quote that, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And we've known that all of our lives. So we see agape is the highest example of love. We see philia is liking people, having acquaintances and friends. And that's important. And then there's eros. Eros does not necessarily appear in the Greek New Testament, but so many examples of it do, as well as in the Old Testament. Eros is a sexual attraction, can involve sexual love, often can lead to lust. It can be used for good or bad, depending on the context. God created eros. He created hormones. And he says, this is low, it's very good, it belongs in a marriage situation. Unfortunately, in our society, Hollywood, magazines, and some of them you can see at the checkout, Cosmopolitan, Vanity Fair, Allure, Red Book, Maxim, Plain Sight, suggest that eros can lead to all kinds of other activities that it will endorse, that they will endorse. And that is almost to be expected anymore in a society so influenced by Satan. It's sad that all of that can't exist in a regular marriage. But eros is certainly not the same as philia. Eros is a feeling. Some people think, I have a feeling for so-and-so, but that's based usually on eros. When people come to have a deep commitment to each other, it's not always predicated on feelings. In one time, there was an interview with some kindergarten children, and a girl age 5 was asked, well, what is love? And she says, well, I know what love is. That's when my granddad loves my grandma. Well, how does that happen? Well, she said, she was age 5, my grandmother has arthritis, and she can't reach over anymore and paint her toenails. So grandpa gets down on his knees, and then he does it for her. And so in her mind, that was love. Now, that's not bad for 5 years of age. Did that come from a feeling? No, not at all. Now, sometimes there is body chemistry and there's feelings. Now, God created that. And he says in Song of Solomon, don't stir it up before it's time, because you can create all kinds of excitement. Let's take a look at Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, just before Isaiah. Chapter 1 and verse 1. Song of Solomon, chapter 1. Beautiful story. Well, it is. You could give several sermons on this, but it, at least in the physical realm, talks about a romance between two lovers that has a blessing of good health and all the hormones that you could imagine. And in Psalms chapter. Song of Solomon 1, verse 1. We'll start verse 2. I'll read this here, New King James version, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is better than wine, because of the fragrance of your good ointments. Your name is ointment poured forth. Draw, therefore, the virgins love you. Draw me away. You see the passion that's expressed. We go on to chapter 2 and verse 10. It says, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you the ornaments of gold with studs of silver. While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance, a bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me. That lies, goes on to postmarital marriage activity. Verse 9 of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 9. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes and with one link of your necklace. Oh, how fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. Much better than wine is your love. So there's great passion. And in chapter 5, verses 10 through 15. These feelings cannot happen without eros. That's what it is. And we'll talk about some of the chemistry of it in a minute here. But in chapter 5, in verse 10 through 15, we can see the following. Because my love is radiant and ruddy, he stands out above 10,000 other men. At least in her mind, that's the way. His head is pure gold. His hair is thick and wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves at the edge of a stream, mounted like jewels and bathed in pools of milk. His bearded cheeks are like a spice garden with towers of spice, his lips dripping and flowing with myrrh. His hands are like strong rods of gold, each set with jewels. His body displays his manhood like an ivory tusk inlaid with sapphires. His legs are like pillars of white marble, both set on bases of gold. Now, one of the reasons that somebody could start talking that way is because of a physical phenomenon called dopamine. Dopamine. And I think that's worth discussing very quickly here. In one article that's entitled Love, Addiction, and Dopamine on the Brain, in a study done at Rutgers University, the following writer makes the following assessment. She says, she opens by saying, quote, at some point in life, most of us will face a potential major mental health crisis. It is called love. She notes that, tongue-in-cheek here, but she notes that recent studies of brain scans, quote, showed that being in love causes changes in the brain that are strikingly similar. This is with MRI study. Changes in the brain that are strikingly similar to serious health problems like drug addiction and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Falling in love may be a kind of addictive behavior, even though we have not often seen it that way. Falling in love model goes along with the image of needing another person to make you complete. When we, quote, need another to feel complete, falling in love becomes a way to fill the void, just like the substances and processes we become addicted to. Find a love to, quote, fill the void, she writes, is a sad motivation, really. Perhaps this is why people feel so vulnerable and anxious when they open their hearts in the falling in love model. In many ways, they're opening their hearts into a void, and this is dangerous, especially when they don't know the other person. Falling in love has always seemed dangerous to me. The falling image of a person's heart standing on the edge of a high cliff and willingly jumping off into the potential dangers of the valley below has never been appealing to me. When you fall like that, you are likely to get hurt, if not killed. Falling in love also implies a lack of conscious participation. Something that you can fall into is not a conscious choice, but something that takes you or happens to you to also, you can, quote, fall into, and yet you could fall out of. Well, we're to take responsibility for our own actions. Subjects dealing with failed relationships showed activity in the dopamine system, suggesting that they maintained intense feelings for their loved one, but that they also showed activity in brain regions associated with risk-taking, controlling anger, and obsessive-compulsive problems. Notably, the scans showed activity in one part of the brain linked even with physical pain. Given that many relationships end abruptly and dramatically or very quietly, the result of years of words never spoken, essential conversations that never have taken place, it is not surprising that the ending of a relationship can evoke primal and irrational responses. She writes again, I have grown to believe that there is another way to enter the chamber of love that is more conscious in a present progression. If two people feel a connection and find that they have common values and interests and enjoy one another's company, why not together embark on a pathway of joining one another in a space of loving and being loved? No falling required, more of a gentle walk forward. Some on one's own and some side by side, slowly opening one's heart to the other and together building a special place of mutual love. Doesn't sound as exciting as a dramatic falling in love. Perhaps it won't give you the same romantic high that parallels the brain chemistry of the drug addict, but I bet if we studied the brain chemistry of two people consciously creating space of mutual love, we would see good things happen. The dopamine is an important chemical that is released, and God created dopamine in everything that was, says is very good, but it belongs in this proper context. There are numerous places in the Song of Solomon that says that we can stir up love before its time, and we can feel this rush of emotion and see what we want to see, and that happens so often, and it can be a blessing in the right time and place, or it could be a very, very difficult situation. Eros is not agape love. And yet people throw around, I love this person or whatever. They may or may not ever understand what agape is all about. A marriage can potentially thrive without eros if it has agape. But if people want to have a relationship on eros, sexual attraction, that's all it is, it will fail. It will get old. And dopamine itself, well, it may intense in a relationship, but it'll last about 2 years. You know, people that, like Elizabeth Taylor, that have gone through seven husbands, there's not a whole lot of dopamine left for marriage number 6 and 7 and 8. That's true. In agape, in the marriage covenant, when it says, do you take this person in sickness and in health? The answer is yes. Or else we're not going to perform the ceremony. It's terrible in our throwaway society how people use up other people and spit them out. It's terrible. In a hospital in South Florida, I learned from somebody that I visited that in one of the hospitals, 3/4 of the women with serious cancer problems that are life-threatening are abandoned by their husbands. It's a throwaway generation. Well, you know, I'll get somebody else, or, you know, this doesn't match up. I'm not getting in return what I want. People can promise the moon. They can say sweet things because they feel lovey-dovey. They got that dopamine going. Woo! And after that, you know, oh, something doesn't go my way. Your history, you know, where's the next person? That's tragic. But there are people that are not street smart, unfortunately, in this way to understand that there are those that are going to be users and abusers and exploiters. That'll say whatever to have one more conquest, and then they're gone. Eros in Philadelphia by itself is not enough. Some people that never get past philia think, well, marriage, it's a 50-50 proposition. I do my half. My mate does his or her half. And if that mate shrinks back 10%, then I'm only going to do my 40%. And then it's, well, tit for tat, 30, 20. Well, I'm putting up my 5%. She'll put up hers. And you don't have a relationship. We've taught, especially in the past, marriage is 100-100. percentage relationship. Because sometimes one or the other may get sick, may get injured, may have an accident, whatever. And maybe the other one has to do a little bit more. Maybe the first is doing everything, but their extended family demands. You can't have a conditional relationship if it's going to be a serious and a strong relationship. So it's so important to think past common culture. There are so many songs out there that promote the idea that Eros is really all the love you need. Eros is, you know, what you feel. Well, I think that every young person would love to have a happy marriage, and I think you can expect that. Even with everything going on in this world, and the world civilization crashing down around us, I don't see why our youth can't expect in this lifetime to be happily married. And I would imagine, being healthy, that they would want to have some Eros in the relationship, as well as philia, as well as agape. You know, why God wants all three. But it has to be in the right context. B.J. Thomas, years ago, came up with the song, "I got hooked on a feeling, hooked on a feeling, I can't stop this feeling. Girl, you don't realize all the love when we're all alone." That's dopamine at work. No, it's true. When somebody says, "Oh, you have the sound of a turtle dove, and you've got thighs like marble, and your, you know, eyes are like inset sapphire and you know, ivory and so forth," you might want to call 911 on that person. I mean, this is not normal stuff, but it's what people do. Something when they're falling in love, "I could have danced all night," and on it goes. Elvis said, "I'm all shook up." That's what makes the world go round. If you think, "Oh well, you know, that was old," go back to before anybody was born. You know, "She'll hold your hand, and you hold hers, and that's a very good sign. She'll be your Tootsie Wootsie." Have you ever heard of that phrase? Man, these people are off the deep end. Tootsie Wootsie. And you go back, you pick a century, any century, and dopamine was alive and well. So, when Eros sometimes is gone, then the dopamine is gone, and life seems to get rough, some people will abandon. Now there's others that say, "You know what? As time goes on, I understand these things more and more. I'm going to be the woman, or I'm going to be the man. I'm going to be responsible. I'm going to do whatever." And things turn and go well for people. Anywhere, at any time, a relationship can blossom. But it has to involve agape love. That's God's Spirit working in to help us to think past our own selfish inclinations to try to enhance the life of the other person. And you never see that in a philia relationship, really. And when people say, "I'm in love, I've got this feeling, or I have these feelings for you," unless there's some agape there, look out. If they say, "I love you," and I saw this in high school. I have let you in on a secret. When I went to high school, the dinosaurs were on the earth. But I tell you this, everybody that was in the fast lane, excited about life, they're either all in jail today or they're dead. Even 20 years ago, I could have said that. And I went to the University of Vermont. And everybody that was in the fast lane, dead, or close to, had brushes with death, or sad for all kinds of other reasons. And everything, every single one of the people I knew, all of my friends, wanted to have a deep and loving relationship with somebody. They was either handsome, beautiful, athletic, whatever it was. And so many people struck out, one after another. It's happened, it's common in society. People don't know what real love is. And actually, we've defined it. You can come up with three different concepts in the Greek language. People can throw love around the phrase very loosely. I'd like for us to go to 2 Samuel 13. This story is not that enlightening or positive, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. 2 Samuel 13. But it is part of the reality of our of history, and this scene has played out over and over in other venues. 2 Samuel chapter 13. This was when King David was on the throne and his sons had grown up. He had been married to several different wives. Chapter 13, verse 1. And this Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar. And beauty ran through the family. David was handsome, Tamar was beautiful. And Ammon, the son of David, would be half-brother to Tamar. Ammon was so distressed over his sister Tamar that he became sick, for she was a virgin. It was improper for Ammon to do anything to her, and he couldn't marry her. That would be considered incest. But Ammon had a friend whose name was Jonadab. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. He said to him, "Well, why, you're the king's son, becoming thinner every day." You know, he was so locked in and absorbed. There are some people that they get so fixated on a person, they'll stalk them. I remember talking to a stalker one time back in Pasadena. He was peripheral to the college and activities. He thought he was a really mature guy because he'd been in the military and he was about 2 or 3 years older than all the students. And he found this one, and he was going to fixate on her. And possibly that was dopamine and contributing. Possibly Satan could have been a part of this. But there are people out there. It's a real thing. And he was going to ask. He knew this one was girl, student, was the one to marry. And he wouldn't leave her alone. And I finally watched him stalk once at a dance. And it was like he was totally oblivious to everybody else. It was something terribly wrong. And finally, that one didn't work, and then he married somebody else who didn't know him, and that lasted a couple months. It's dangerous, and people can do that. They can be so convinced of what they feel, but what they feel a lot of times is not love. And this is the way it was for Ammon. He was actually a brute, and so he decided that he was going to have a relationship with her. He said to this Jonadab, he says, "I love Tamar." Ammon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." And so Jonadab gave him some disgusting advice. "Why don't you pretend to be sick, and then you call her in and send everybody else away, and then go after her." And that's exactly what happened. He was a con artist, and he sent everybody out. He says, "Oh, I'm sick." Another lie. She didn't know him well enough. And so she came in. That was naive, to be in a bedroom with somebody like that. And everybody else disappears. And then he made these unbelievable demands on her. And she should have screamed and run away. But she still tried to reason with him. "No, my brother, don't force me." This is verse 12. "For such a thing should not be done in Israel." Well, she knew better. "Don't do this." Then she suggests that, you know, "Please speak to the king. Well, he will not withhold me from you." Maybe that was just a ploy to reason. But if she had screamed, that might have saved her. And tried to run. I don't know if she could have. But what's the real kicker in verse 15 is that after the interlude with her, verse 15, then Ammon hated her exceedingly. Well, wait a minute. Time out. He just said he loved her. Why, if you can't believe somebody that's that passionate, well, who can you believe? These things are dangerous. And so I say that, and as a community, as mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, grandparents, uncles, aunts, friends, and all, we need to be there for each other and support each other as a community, a family community, and hold each other up and give reassurance and all so that we don't allow our people to get sucked in by this. I'm impressed when some people take responsibility, but there are others that when they use people, then they're gone for the next and the next. I've seen this so much. And can remember another time while you years in the church, we had several guys that were interested in some of our women. And one was a heavy drug addict and sold drugs. And he pretended to be interested in the church. He says, "Wow, I've really gone through this literature and I see what's going to happen." And he was able to fake it for about 2 weeks. And finally, when the truth was known, he was asked not to come back. And you just can't allow these things to eat people up. It's not fair. I think the one thing, if anybody of us believe in, is fairness. Compliments should be coming from the family rather than people that don't have the best interests of another at heart. Now, one last thing before we move on to some other aspects. Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. Says in verse 19, there is a way of things. There's a way of an eagle, for example, in the air. And if you've ever had the opportunity to see one soaring, you realize how majestic that is. And even some of the large predator birds besides that, even a vulture. I am amazed how they can be stationary in the air with a little bit of wind and swoop down effortlessly. It's an amazing creation that God has just that. There is a way of a serpent on a rock, it says. And there is a way of a ship in the middle of the sea. And when you see a ship, maybe in 20-foot waves, it's well-designed, it has a keel, has a rudder, and it's able to, with the right steering, right piloting, manage and negotiate through the waves. It's really, really quite an interesting scene. And along in the same context, it says, and, verse 19, there is a way of a man with a maid. There is a way of a man with a maid. It seems like God has given women various insights and intuition, and there is a way of a woman with a man. But sometimes a man may be able to say the right things, but you want to know that there's something behind it, something that's real and genuine, that is outgoing concern. There was a person by the name of Rose who wrote Dear Abby and said, quote, "I wish I could find a man with no flaws." Dear Abby said, "Dear Rose, so do I." Nobody's perfect. We need to balance with realism. But idealism can be beautiful, but it belongs in a secure relationship. The world promotes philia, it promotes eros. All these different songs. I'm going to make him mine, or I'm going to make her mine. That's pretty conditional. There was one that came out years ago, "Hey little devil, going to make an angel out of you." What happens if it doesn't work? Well, I guess he dumps her. You know, she's... "I got you, babe." How about Elvis putting the pressure on? "It's now or never," you know. Well, is that fair? Is that love? No, that's Eros. He's all wound up, but he's ready to dump her if something doesn't happen. That's not love. That's very, very conditional. You can't build a relationship on that. And unfortunately, that's idolized. That's popular. "Strangers in the Night," Sinatra's number one hit. What were their chances of exchanging glances? What was their chances of making love before the night was through? Are you kidding me? They didn't even know each other existed 24 hours earlier. But this is what's popular. This is what's reinforced. Now, I tried, in fairness, to go on the internet and come up with some more modern music and lyrics of that. But the lyrics were so bad, I gave up. But I want to hammer home, once and for all, love by itself, true love, the agape love, is not a feeling. And so, with that in mind, I'd like for us to take the remaining time and revisit the five love languages. And this is not the Bible, but it is something worth looking at because it is a tool. Gary Chapman's book, Five Love Languages, which are, 1, affirmation, 2, quality time communication, 3, receiving gifts, 4th is acts of service, 5th is physical touch, which involves more than sexual intercourse, but it would include that. And so it would be those five. Now, I did a sermon many years ago on that and made some reference probably 4 years ago. So this is not totally new, but these are different languages in a sense. For example, some people will say the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Might be true for a woman. But in reality, the way to a man's heart is through his 1 or 2 love languages. Generally speaking, everybody likes all five, but we predominantly are involved in 1 or 2. And many times when people get married, they marry somebody that has different love languages. Not always, but most of the time. When we were dating, and that dopamine was around, and we were trying to be very careful, to put a best foot forward, careful to say helpful things, to do things, we probably did not know it, but we were speaking in perhaps all the different love languages at the time, and we were making connections here and there. And when you receive something in your love language, the tendency is to say, wow, I'm going to do something nice in return. And you have this reciprocation. And the love cups are full of the two involved. And you add to that dopamine, and wow. You've got Jerry Lee Lewis and his song, Gotta Tell a Squirrel You're Mine, Mine, Mine. You know, just that kind of excitement. On the other hand, I remember, and I've used this once, the song that Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond sang together, You Don't Bring Me Flowers. To me, that's a terrible song because they sing about problems and it ends where there's nothing is resolved. But consider, let's break this down like game film, you know, after a football game. She says, You don't bring me flowers. What's her love language? Out of the five, gifts. And he sang in response, And you don't sing me songs when I come home at the end of a day. His love language, probably quality time, communication, wants to hear things like that. And she ignores that. She says, I remember when you loved me all night. Physical touch. And he sings, basically saying, Well, I can't see connecting in your love language when you don't connect and communicate with me in mine. It's almost as if a Russian speaks to a Spaniard. And the Russian says, if I get this right, Izvinichi, moi druk. Ya idu na pochtu, poslat mi smo. And the Spaniard says, Hombre, con toda la franqueza sus consejos, no los necesito. Now, what was that conversation all about? He said, my friend in Russian, excuse me, I have to go mail a letter at the post office. And she said, listen, wacko, I don't need your advice. Was that a conversation? No. The two tried to communicate and went, whoop, whoop. They missed each other. They are ending up in two different worlds. And that's what can happen when we are speaking. Maybe my love language is to gift gifts. And so to my mate or my fiance or whatever, I'm constantly giving things, and that person doesn't really care about gifts. Those of you that like to give gifts think, oh, that's crazy. And others will say, yeah, that makes sense. And so how do you connect? You connect on the level of the people. Zsa Gabor, who is very Hungarian, she said, women, they love with their ears. Well, that sounds to me like affirmation. That whoever reach her heart would say sweet things, and hopefully they'd be sincere. But you know, she had 9 husbands. Did she have to, was the number 9 the first one that understood the value of speaking affirmations to her? I think you're wonderful. I think you're great. Now, it has to be sincere. What if Zsa Zsa Gabor married somebody from West Texas who said, I'm going to help my honey lamb. I'm going to give her a gift that she'll never refuse. I'm giving her a barbecue pit. I'm going to build that. And she's looking for sweet, sweet statements. You're the Rose of Sharon. You're like a symphony, you know, that Mendelssohn wrote and so forth. And he's never heard of the guy. And if she don't have, if she's already got a barbecue pit, I'm going to build her a septic grain field. I know she needs that. That's missing. Missing. Not connection. But if you have people that really believe in agape, they subscribe to that. That's what the church endorses. And that's what they want to do. And that's a way of life to be more successful, to economize time. We're going to want to communicate in a language that's going to be understood, that's going to be able to be received. So a lot of times when things go awry, it's not that there's a bad woman involved or a bad guy or whatever. It's just that they're not using the arsenal of love language in the way that they could. But you have to want to make it happen. And wanting to is understanding of the three Greek terms. I subscribe to agape. And if health permits, maybe there's eros. And I want to like as well as love my mate or future mate. But agape is going to want to make an effort. I think a beautiful application of that is in Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 21. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 21. Well, let's start in verse 20. Talking about giving thanks always for the things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And going on, as Paul's talking about marriage, submitting to one another in the fear of God. In the fear of God, you see the greatness of God and His power and His majesty, and understanding the marvelous plan of God and plan for the family, and being in awe of that, submitting to one another, giving to one another, and in the love languages that the other can relate to. That is a recipe for inspiring reciprocity. Aspiring a response in return. Because when people receive things in their love languages, they're more inclined to say, well, I'm going to give back. I'm going to. Especially if they know what the love language of another is. It can make a world of difference. And here, we're matching rather than patching. One last example, and I'll need to close this pretty quickly. Dr. Chapman said one person once in counseling, my wife is a gourmet cook. She spends hours in the kitchen. She makes elaborate meals. But me, I'm a meat and potatoes man myself. Ouch. It's not what she wants to hear. I tell her she's wasting her time. Ouch, ouch. I like simple food. She gets hurt and says I don't appreciate her. I just wish she would make it easy on herself and not spend so much time in the kitchen. Then we would have more time together and she would have the energy to do the other things. Well, we can figure out what the other things are. Physical touch. And the wife, in a candor, said to the counselor, he says, well, I grew up with a mom who was an excellent cook. Her dad appreciated it. Her dad used to say, when I sit down to meals like this, it's so easy for me to love you. The problem was, she was not married to her father. She was married to somebody else who spoke a different language, different love language. He spoke the language of affirmation. She could cook elaborate meals till she was blue in the face, and the rest of the world could say, hey, you're doing a whale of a job. And it wouldn't do anything for him. And he obviously wasn't doing anything for her. He could have said, found different ways to praise her and to thank her. So in retrospect, what happens to love after wedding? One of two things. It either increases or it decreases. Or in some relationships, can do both over years. It can flourish or it can disappear. It works best when two marriage partners, or at least one of them, invests agape into the relationship and has some knowledge as to where to invest, where to sow the seed, and where not to sow the seed. Are we willing to speak in another person's love language? Well, if we're going to be together, why not? And if another doesn't understand this, maybe they need to wait before getting married. Because these are very, very important. This is what helps make the human race revolve. So in retrospect, in conclusion, there are three different aspects of love as defined in the Greek language: eros, philia, and agape. It should be our goal to strive for agape, because that's where the best results occur. That's what makes everything else happen. As far as eros, and as we age, there is tendency for that to diminish. A lot of that can be managed or enhanced or expanded by a diet strategy, which is a subject that's outside the realm of this sermon. But things don't have to be stationary, even in that area, as is demonstrated by people that are passionate, even in their 70s and 80s and beyond. It is possible. But eros, philia, and agape can exist in many a marriage and is what makes the world go around, in one sense. So let's strive to do that. Let's aim for agape. Let's appreciate the fact that there are different ways of communicating with other people, and look to stir up love in the right context where it does belong, and see what we can do to change what love we have after the wedding.